As Pope Francis reaches 10 years in office, we're going to reflect on his confusing, ideological, and scandalous papacy. More importantly, we're also going to talk about how Catholics should react to living under a bad pope. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I want to encourage people to smash that like button, to subscribe to the channel, but don't hit the notify button. Also, you can follow us on social media at Crisis Mag. I say this every podcast, so if you listen normally, you should know all of this. Okay, so I'm recording this. It's March 14th, 2023. Yesterday, March 13th, 2023, was the 10-year anniversary of the election of Jorge Bergoglio as the Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. And of course, he took the name Francis. Interestingly, I had a memory pop up on Facebook today, in which I had a very positive hopes for Francis as the Pope. I'm not one of those who went into this papacy expecting troubles. Now, I can't remember exactly what I said on Facebook. It was something to the effect of, I think this Pope could be a very good evangelizer because of his commitment to the poor and penance and something else. I was clearly wrong. But I did come into the papacy with a positive attitude. Now, I wrote an editor's desk article yesterday at Crisis Magazine. I encourage you to check that out, where I talked about how the Francis papacy has been confusing, politically ideological, and scandalous. I'm not going to go through all of that here, but I wanted to talk about this some more because I think it's an important topic for Catholics to discuss openly and honestly. I think most Catholics are very hung up about the papacy. And what I mean by that is we don't know how to talk about it when we don't agree with the Pope, what he's doing, when we think what he's doing isn't good for the faith. We get hung up about it. We get tied up in knots. I'm talking about faithful Catholics here. We don't know how to react. What do we say? Do we criticize him? Are we allowed to say this is a bad papacy? I mean, I have people criticize me for even saying that. Are we supposed to just pretend everything is okay? I mean, yesterday the USCCB tweeted something to the fact of how grateful they are of all the great works of Francis. And it's like there comes a point, though, where we have to be honest. I mean, I feel like as Catholics, we always have to be honest. We always have to not shy away from the truth. Even if the truth is very uncomfortable, even if the truth might seem to us to lead people away from the faith, because ultimately the truth always leads people to Jesus Christ, who is the truth. And so even if it's an uncomfortable truth, a truth that might make us, make others maybe shy away from the faith, maybe it might even harm our own faith. We cannot shy away from the truth itself. And so we have to give an honest assessment of our current pontiff. I mean, it's an interesting thing because our hangups are mostly about popes that are alive when we're alive. Most Catholics don't have any problem criticizing, for example, a pope from the 15th century or from the pornocracy of the 10th century. We're very free to say, yeah, that pope was terrible. But when it comes to our own popes, the popes that that we're under, we really have a hard time with that. And part of that is theological, in that the church has declared at times, the magisterium has declared at times, that really we should give this full submission of mind and will to the actions, the statements of the Pope, even when they're not infallible. I think that understanding that, we really need a deep dive into that. Talked about that in the past. But at the same, I think they're more psychological than they are theological. We just don't feel comfortable criticizing the current Pope. We're afraid that if we do, that somehow makes us a bad Catholic. Now, at the same time, I also think that especially in the traditionalist Catholic world, there is a potential to obsess over a bad Pope and to talk about all the time. You'll note here, I try not to do that in this podcast. I definitely have criticized Francis in the past. I've mentioned some of the problems of his papacy, but I don't hammer it home every single podcast. I'm not always talking about how bad Francis is or anything like that. So I do think there's a balance. And I think in this situation, when we live under a Pope that is not doing a good job as Pope, I think we need to be honest about it. We need to be direct about it, but we can't obsess over it. So with that in mind, I want to talk a little bit about some of the problems of this papacy. I mean, obviously, if I say it's a bad papacy, I have to have some reasons behind that. I think that what we have to do is, okay, let me take a step back here. Let's go through some of the problems. Let me do that, and I'll talk a little bit more about how we handle this, how we deal with this in a minute. But so 10 years ago, yesterday, the Pope was elected. Now, for most of us, he was an unknown. Most of us had no idea. I remember I was working for a diocese at the time, and I heard the white smoke had gone up, and so they had a TV running in the conference room at the chancery where I worked. So we all huddled in there to hear the announcement of the next Pope. And I think all of us there were like, who? We had never heard of this man who became Pope. And so, like I said already, I definitely gave him benefit of doubt first. In fact, I was just like, okay, this could be great. I mean, I don't know. I don't know anything about him. Now, I did hear some people very quickly criticizing him. I remember like Rorate Cheli blog was like, this is going to be a problem. And I felt like that was just a little bit premature. And some other places, mostly traditional Catholic places, were immediately suspicious. Whereas most conservative Catholic outlets and personalities were like, oh, let's just see. And that's where I was definitely. Now, the first indication to me, and I think to a lot of people, of that this papacy might not go the way we hoped was the "Who am I to judge" comment that he made. I think that was in September of 2013. I can't remember exactly the date, but it was in context of homosexual priests. And he basically said, "Who am I to judge?" And it was very confusing. It wasn't really clear. Was he saying that he wasn't judging homosexual activity, or what was he talking about? But of course, that was the problem, is that it was confusing. I was one of those who very quickly defended, Pope explained it, said, well, you know, he's not saying this. And it's true. If you look at that in a vacuum, that statement, there probably are ways you can parse it so it's not heretical. It's not a real problem. I mean, now a theological problem is definitely a problem proclamation of how he declared what he believed. And in fact, that was one of my initial reactions was, well, it's hard being Pope. He was a Cardinal Archbishop in Argentina, which doesn't quite have the same cachet as the Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. Maybe he doesn't realize that the way he said this could be confusing. But then, of course, he never did anything to clarify it. And that's when I started getting worried. The initial comment, I was like, well, okay, he just misspoke. People do that. But then when he didn't clarify it really in the future, that's when I started getting worried. Now, I had a big moment where I got nervous that I don't think anybody else shares with me on this one. I mean, a lot of people have different comments they heard that made them nervous. But for me, I think a big moment was when his encyclical Evangelii Gaudium came out. This was in November 2013, so less than a year before he was elected. Now, this was a big deal for me because it was about evangelization, and I was a director of evangelization at a diocese. So for me, I took this as, okay, I'm about to get marching orders from the big boss, my boss's boss. My boss is the bishop. His boss was the Pope. I was about to get directions from him on how to evangelize and details about that. And I remember reading it, and I read the whole thing. And I remember reading it. And at the beginning, I was like, okay, this is good stuff. Some good theoretical about the importance of evangelization, about the importance of proclamation, things like that. It's like good stuff. But then we started getting into details. I'll admit my heart started to sink because all of a sudden it seemed to shift into a very political document. It was talking much more about just things that really are not completely unrelated to evangelization, but not really the point, the spiritual point of evangelization, which is to convert souls to Christ. It was talking much more about political situations, world affairs, and things of that nature. And so for me, it's not like after reading that, I was like, oh, this Pope isn't very good. I just remember thinking like, what a disappointment. Because when I would read encyclicals by John Paul II or by Benedict XVI, I was like, wow, this is good stuff. I really, you know, I appreciate this. I understand what he's saying. And so at that time, I was just like, well, you know, it's just my personal opinion of his writing style, what he decides to focus on. But it wasn't like all of a sudden I was like, well, he's a bad pope. I still thought, okay, that's just me, my personal opinions on this. Then the hits started just kept on coming, I guess we could put it. He had the comment about the breeding like rabbits, which I think is somewhat infamous. And again, all these things on my list, and by the way, this list I made of things that I feel like real problems, I literally spent about 5 minutes. I just jotted them down. I didn't try to do any research. I didn't try to look back at things I had said in the past. I just was like, okay, off the top of my head, what are some things that this Pope has done that are at least problematic? And so the breeding like rabbits comment where he talked about that Catholics don't have to breed like rabbits. I felt that was very demeaning. I know my wife was personally offended by that. I was offended by that because, you know, with 7 kids, I think at the time I had 6 when he made the comment, but I felt like it was somewhat of a demeaning of the life we chose to live. And not only that, but the life we chose to live as faithful Catholics. It wasn't just like our personal decision, okay, we're going to have lots of kids. No, our decision was we want to be faithful Catholics, and faithful Catholics are open to life. And so because of that, we believe God gave us a good number of children. Obviously, he doesn't give everybody who's open to life a lot of children, but he did for us. We felt very grateful for that fact. And so then when he kind of demeaned the idea of having a lot of kids with breeding like rabbits, that was a moment for me, I will say, where I was like, this is not something I like to hear from the Pope. I'd rather hear encouragement for living, trying to be a faithful Catholic rather than demeaning the lifestyle. I don't know, in order to be more accepted by the rest of the world, who knows why he said it. Then another thing I have on the list, so is his constant comments against conversions to a Catholic faith. This is not a one-time thing. He often demeans conversions to Catholicism. I mean, he had the one I remember that stands out in my mind, although there's been many instances of this. This is not a one-time thing. Is when somebody introduced him to a friend who had converted to Catholicism. And he used that as an opportunity later to basically rail on the lady who had introduced her friend who converted to Catholicism, saying how she, I don't know, triumphalistic. And the way he tells the story is she didn't say anything other than the fact that here's my friend who converted, I think, from Lutheranism to Catholicism. It was the fact that she was happy that her friend converted that he was upset about, that he seemed to think that was a problem, that she was being triumphalistic. But that goes against 2,000 years of Christianity. We're supposed to be happy when somebody converts. In fact, that's what we're supposed to desire for our friends and our family, for everybody, the conversion to Catholicism. Yet he seemed to be upset about it. And again, this wasn't a one-off where, okay, maybe he misspoke. Maybe we don't know the whole story. Over and over again, whenever he talked about stories of conversion to Catholicism, it was in a negative light, not in a positive light. And I just felt like, how is that something the Pope is supposed to be talking about? How is the Pope supposed to be saying things that demean conversion? So that was a real problem. Another aspect of this problematic papacy is his relationship with the Chinese Communist Party, and that he seems to revel in railing on, for example, American politics, Donald Trump or whoever. And if people know me, I'm not a huge Donald Trump fan. Yet Francis seemed to love to find ways to insult Donald Trump, usually obliquely. He wouldn't necessarily say his name. But he didn't have those criticisms for the Chinese Communist Party and his relationship with them and making deals with them, with the Chinese Patriotic Church and things of that nature, which Cardinal Zinn, who is a hero, and a saint, he is criticized very strongly. So that's another thing. And just his cozying up to communism. I know some people say he is a communist. I'm not willing to say that, but he clearly clearly flirts with communism. He seems to want to impress. It's like the girl who wants to impress the, uh, the quarterback of the football team. He seems to act like that with communism. And so that's obviously a problem, since communism is directly antithetical to Christianity. Look at my podcast with Paul Kingore for some details about that. Another big problem of this papacy is his appointments. I mean, just look in America. There's other countries this is true too, but in America alone, how he has favored certain people who are the worst of our prelates. Cardinal Supich, Cardinal McElroy, Cardinal Gregory. And then he doesn't elevate good men. So, for example, Archbishop Chaput never became a cardinal. Archbishop Gomez never became a cardinal, has not yet become a cardinal, and likely won't, even though he's Archbishop of Los Angeles. These appointments, I mean, I feel like appointments more than anything say what the Pope wants the church to be like. In fact, this is probably one of my biggest criticisms of Pope John Paul II, his papacy, is his appointments oftentimes were terrible. But for Francis, he seems to really be trying to appoint the worst people to the most important tasks. And you see this also in his I think it's 9 cardinals that are his close inner circle, and then also appointments he makes at the Vatican and the Curia. These are some of the worst prelates we have. And so the fact is that so many of his appointments have been bad, and I think that's a real reflection of this papacy. Obviously, a major mark against this papacy is former Cardinal McCarrick and what happened with him. Now, in the McCarrick story, none of the last 3 popes come out looking good. So I don't want to make it like Francis is the only one who was bad when it came to McCarrick. That's not the case. John Paul II allowed him to write. He's the one who appointed to become a cardinal. And even though he was engaged in these terrible activities, of which there were already some rumors, whether or not they got to JP2, we don't know for sure. But the fact is, JP2 did appoint him cardinal. And then under Benedict seemed to definitely know something was wrong with McCarrick, and so he sidelined him, but he didn't publicly remove him from office, from being a cardinal. He didn't laicize him or anything like that. He didn't make anything public. He basically just said, stay quiet. And McCarrick kind of did, kind of didn't. But that's on Benedict for not taking stronger action against this monster. But then with Francis, I think Francis is the worst of the 3 when it comes to McCarrick. Francis then basically brings him back into the inner circle, so to speak. He lets him now become public again and working for Francis. And I do believe he knew. I believe Vigano's testimony that he told him, and I do believe that Francis knew McCarrick had a lot of baggage in his past, to say the least. Yet he still let him go. And the reason I think he knew, I do believe the testimony of people who say he knew, but also because he's appointed other monsters and allowed other monsters to thrive in his church. I mean, the most recent example is Father Rupnik, I think that's how you pronounce it, the Jesuit priest who is the artist who does that horrendous diabolical artwork, yet he has had no problem succeeding in the church, even though he had these terrible accusations against him and excommunication being lifted. I mean, I think, you know, it's clear if you were ideologically aligned with Francis, there's a different standard towards you than there is towards somebody who's not ideologically aligned with Francis. I think that's probably the best way to put it. That if Francis can use you to further his agenda, his ideological agenda, he's not going to punish people, even if you have baggage, even abuse accusations against you. This is something I don't get. I mean, this shows the ideology here. Because a lot of left Catholics who have actually been good on the abuse crisis, like they've been quick to condemn when there's credible accusations of abuse against priests or bishops, they have completely not criticized Francis on this. All because he's their guy. And it's like, that's just ridiculous. I don't care if he's our guy or not. Like, I have criticisms against JP2, against Benedict, and against Francis when it comes to the handling of the abuse crisis. In fact, I would say JP2 was probably the worst of the three. And it doesn't matter that I like Benedict or JP2 better than I like Francis. That's irrelevant. The fact is Francis has been terrible on this. Okay, going on my list again, Amoris Letizia, a disaster. I'm not even talking about the footnote, which basically seems to open up the idea of divorced and remarried Catholics receiving communion. That's bad enough. But if you read it, especially chapter 8, and I have a podcast about this as well in the past, you can look it up. The problem is it fundamentally tries to change Catholic moral theology. The fundamentals of Catholic moral theology of how acts are gauged to be moral or immoral. It completely upends traditional Catholic morality. And I'm surprised more people haven't seen this. But if you look at it, it very much upends. And like I'm not going to go into details here, but the fact is that is one of the worst papal documents that I can think of, Amoris Letizia. Also his changing of the catechism on the death penalty. And again, there's tons of debates on this from the Pope explainers, especially like he didn't really, yes, he did, he didn't. But the fact is that he went beyond what JP2 did. JP2 basically never tried to undercut the traditional teaching on the death penalty. He simply argued that it wasn't necessary today. And I think that's a position that a Catholic can hold. Francis, however, he attacks the actual admissibility of the death penalty, whether or not you can even do it, because he goes to the heart of it by talking about it's against human dignity to ever execute, the state to ever execute somebody. And I think that's a very different statement than what JP2 did or Benedict did. And so that's another area of a problem. Obviously, all his airplane interviews, I mean, it seems like every time he gets on an airplane, he says something confusing or scandalous. Oh, the Synod on Synodality. The whole issue of synodality is just such a disaster because as somebody who's actually studied the early church and appreciates the Eastern governance style of the church, as you can see in the first millennium, and you see somewhat in Orthodoxy today, Eastern Orthodoxy today, I have a high respect for the importance of synods and of true synodality. However, what Francis and the Vatican is pushing as synodality is not Christian synodality. It's basically you give a name to something of how can we get what we want and make it look like this is the will of the people, or this is the will of, and therefore the will of the people of God, and therefore the will of God. And this upends how the church is governed. The church is governed by bishops and by the Pope. It's not governed by vote of, okay, what do the people say? And I mean, just a German synodal way that just recently happened where they voted on giving blessings to same-sex unions. And so far, the Vatican said nothing, and more than likely, they might say a few words, but they're not going to do anything about it. And so synodality has been the means by which Catholic morality in particular and even Catholic theology has been undermined. And this is something that this Pope has initiated and encouraged. And so this is might be the worst of all the things of this papacy, might be the synodality, because it's the means by which all the other bad things, a lot of them happen. Pachamama, I mean, obviously, I mean, that just is, I mean, what else can we say? It's idolatry. It was allowed at the Vatican, and it was even defended at the Vatican. It's funny, I think, now that leftist Catholics are, their thing is it's racist to say that. They realize they couldn't argue on the point. That's what's always funny. When the left, they can't argue a point, they just fall back on racism or homophobia or misogyny or something like that. And they've fallen back on racism for this. They don't even try to, they know they can't argue the point of whether or not it was idolatry, so they just say it's racism. But obviously that is a low point, probably the low point of this papacy so far is Pachamama idolatry in the Vatican by Vatican officials even, and allowed by them. The crackdown on the traditional Latin Mass. I mean, this one is terrible as well. Even if you don't attend the traditional Latin Mass, this should be something that frightens you as far as the the impetus for it and why it's being done and what it means for the future of the liturgy in general, not just the liturgy, not just the traditional Latin Mass, but just the liturgy in general. I mean, the ordinary, is it in danger? Ad Orientem is being attacked in the Novus Ordo. And so it's a real, this Thielem crackdown. And it just shows the priorities here. When the German synodal way will probably be left alone. Father Rupnik is mostly ignored. Liturgical abuses in Novus Ordo are so common. I could literally pick a church, a local church here on Sunday, and go to just a random mass, and I can guarantee you there will be multiple liturgical abuses there. Just if I pick one at random. I mean, it's possible I'll luck out and I'll get somebody, like one of the few priests here. I mean, it's not even that, I'm not even talking about bad priests. I'm just talking about just in general. But then you talk about the awful stuff that goes on and nothing is done about it, but we have to crack down on traditional Latin Mass. The Abu Dhabi Declaration, that one I've talked about before here. In fact, I just talked about it recently. That clearly fosters religious indifference. That one was awful, in which it basically equates all religions in practice, the way people would interpret it. Let me just give the latest. This is when I heard, after I made the list, I heard this one, how he talked about clerical celibacy being temporary. Now, this is one of those issues where, yes, it is true that clerical celibacy is not a dogma of the church. It's not a requirement of divine revelation. Obviously, in the Eastern Church, Catholic Church, we have married priests. We allow converts from Anglicanism, for example, married priests to remain married and to be priests. So it's not a dogma of the church. Yet again, it's confusing to talk about being temporary, because what that's saying is we're going to overturn it. And that's the plan. But that shouldn't be the plan, because there are very good reasons for clerical celibacy. Very good reasons that are based in an apostolic tradition. This is not something that just came up in the Middle Ages. This has a very deep basis in church history, in church theology, church tradition. And so just to kind of throw it out there as temporary, again, it's just confusing. So that was, like I said, just a few minutes I wrote those down off the top of my head. But clearly what it does is it gives the overall picture. And that is, this is a bad papacy. Catholics cringe when they hear that, when they hear somebody say it's a bad papacy. But I don't know how else you could explain it. Now, there are the Pope explainers out there who will take each of these things I said and somehow have an explanation of why it's not so bad. But here's the thing. Even if I grant you, maybe on an individual level, the volume just, it speaks volumes. The volume of problems speaks volumes. It speaks of a papacy that is confusing, ideological, and scandalous. And it leads souls astray. And that's something we have to acknowledge. And so I really feel like if we don't acknowledge that, what we're doing is we're engaging in gaslighting. If we refuse to say there are problems with this papacy, if we act like everything is awesome, even though we know it's not, we're engaged in gaslighting, basically. And what it does is it undermines our understanding of the standard of Catholicism. Like, what does it mean to be Catholic? What does it mean to believe the Catholic religion? What does it mean to practice the Catholic religion? If we act like everything Francis has done is fine and not a problem, or we just ignore it, then what happens is that it normalizes things that should not be normalized. It should not be normalized that the traditional Latin Mass is a problem. It should not be normalized that Catholics and Muslims have the same name for God. It should not be normalized that having a lot of kids is somehow demeaning and breeding like rabbits. It should not be normalized that Catholic morality is based more on the person's intentions or will than it is on the actual action itself. It should not be normalized that the faith is based upon a vote of the people. All these things cannot be normalized, because if they are, it undermines our ability to proclaim the gospel and bring people to Jesus Christ in the Catholic Church. That's why we can't ignore, just completely put our heads in the sand about the problems of this papacy. We have to speak out about it. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean we freak out about it either. There's a balance here. There's a balance between ignoring the problems, sweeping them under the rug, and freaking out and getting hysterical about them as well. And I do criticize, I'm not going to name names, but I do think there are Catholic outlets and people who do sensationalize too much the problems of this papacy. Most of them are now sedevacantists, continents, frankly. But I really do think that can be a problem. I think we have to have a balanced view of this. What I mean by that is we're very honest and direct about the problems, but we put them in the context of 2,000 years of church history, 2,000 years of church theology, 2,000 years of the gospel being proclaimed, the work of the Holy Spirit in the church. If all we're thinking about is the fact that we have a bad papacy, we have a bad understanding of the role of the papacy in our lives as Catholics. That's a key point I've tried to make over and over here, is that if a bad papacy really disturbs your peace as a Catholic and makes you question your faith, then you fundamentally had a incorrect view of the papacy and its role in our life in the first place. Our faith does not revolve around the papacy. Our faith revolves around Jesus Christ. And so even if we have problems with the papacy, if we live under a pope that is problematic, and problematic, I will admit, I say that word a few times here, it is a weasel word, and so I probably should avoid that. It's bad. I mean, the word bad is the correct word here, not just problematic. This papacy is bad, and there's no other way, two ways about it. And so we can't excuse that. And I found in evangelization, I found that it's actually best to be direct about this and not to try to sweep the problems of this papacy under the rug. Because what happens is outsiders know there's a problem. They recognize that there's a problem. They don't really understand what it is. And if they start to think this is what Catholicism actually is, that's what undermines evangelization. So we need to make clear, no, this is not Catholicism. Isn't that we just simply follow and do and accept every single thing that the current pope says and does and thinks. And so we have to make that clear. So we don't excuse for it. But at the same time, we don't obsess over it. If when talking to non-Catholics, fallen away Catholics, Protestants, whatever, if you're constantly talking about the problems of this pope, that's also a problem. Again, it's that balance. Don't ignore it, but don't obsess over it. And so ultimately, as Catholics living under a bad papacy, and remember, we're not the first Catholics who have lived under a bad pope. Now, there might be some unique aspects of how this particular papacy is bad. I will grant that. But it's not the first papacy that's been bad. There have been others. And so other Catholics have had to deal with this. So I think ultimately the healthiest way to live under a bad papacy is to first and foremost remember to put it in context of 2,000 years, as I already said, that there have been good papacies and bad papacies, but the church endures. Put in the context of the fact that Jesus Christ is the head of the church. He's the invisible head of the church. The pope is his vicar, the visible head, but he answers to Jesus. And so Jesus is the standard by which we gauge the faith, not the pope, not Pope Francis. Pope Francis is not the standard. This is something you see hyperpapalists do all the time, that they make Pope Francis the standard of our faith. He is not the standard. Jesus Christ is. And the 2,000-year tradition of the church, that's our standard for this, for our faith. So we don't make the pope the centerpiece of our life. When something bad happens that this pope does or says, we acknowledge it. We explain it to friends if we need to. And the explanation might be like, yeah, that was bad. It might be also that it wasn't. I mean, there are things he said that people criticize him for. I was like, yeah, it really wasn't a big problem. So we're honest about that. But we don't think about it all the time. So when we say in our prayers, yeah, we make sure we pray for the Pope. We definitely should pray and fast for the Pope, just like we should pray and fast for our bishop, whoever our bishop might be, for the church, for our family, friends, and others. But our prayer life, for example, should not be centered around the Pope and always think about all the problems he does. But instead, it should be based upon the Holy Scriptures, on the writings of the fathers, on obviously Jesus Christ himself, the Gospels. So I think if we do that, if we don't ignore, but we don't obsess, I think that's the healthy way we deal with the bad papacy. And whether or not, you know, will the next papacy be as bad? It could be, could be worse, could be better. That's not up for us to decide. When this Pope finally reaches the end of his earthly life and goes on to his reward, whatever that might be, then we can pray. We can pray and fast, obviously, for the next Pope. But until then, I think we just simply endure this bad papacy, like Catholics in the past have done under bad popes, and we just continue to live our faith in our own lives and make sure we're still joyful disciples of Jesus Christ. Okay, I think I'm going to wrap it up there. I just want to encourage everybody to keep the faith. Don't keep it to yourself. To be joyful that you're Catholic. To love the Catholic faith, even in spite of the fact that the current Pope isn't a great example of it. Okay, I'll leave it there for now. Until next time, everybody, God love you.